Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Mike Reeser, and he'll be answering your most important questions on stalking rooster fish on Baja's East Cape. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you would like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says, click here to ask Mike your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is being copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Mike about stalking rooster fish on Baja's East Cape. The Nantahala River in western North Carolina, near the Great Smoky Mountains, is a renowned destination for whitewater adventurers and fly fishing fanatics. It also offers some one-of-a-kind privileges, such as being one of the nation's top trout streams, night fishing, and last but not least, Mystic River, the only whitewater riverfront community in the eastern U.S. The promise of an unrivaled setting can be yours if you act fast. Mystic River on the Nantahala is releasing its final 15 home sites of this natural treasure. Now is the last chance ever. Call 866-977-4455. Or visit MysticRiverland.com, MysticRiverland.com. That's 866-974-4455 or online at MysticRiverland.com. Before we introduce Mike, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we're giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Mike's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. Well, tonight we welcome Mike Reeser. Mike got the fly fishing bug some 45 years ago at the impressionable age of 10. A keen interest in fly tying quickly followed with raids on his mother's sewing kit and the gathering of feathers and fur from reluctant barnyard critters. In 1973, Mike made his first trip down the Baja, where he would spend the next 15 winters camping on the beaches and fishing flies in this new fly fishing frontier. A great deal of time was spent camping and fishing with the handline fishermen, the Panjeros, who, despite their skepticism about fishing with the wimpy rod Mike had, shared their knowledge of the Sea of Cortez and its great variety of fish. Through trial and error, the methods evolved to catch many species, such as roosterfish, once deemed impossible on the fly. This foundation of knowledge and experience would eventually lead to the foundation of the Baja Fly Fishing Company in 1997. Always innovative, Mike has developed tactics and fly patterns effective on a wide variety of species that swim the Sea of Cortez. Mike and the other guides at Baja Fly Fishing spent considerable time in pursuit of roosterfish, with many large fish landed by Baja fly fishing clients each year. Besides guiding on the Baja, Mike has worked as a fly fishing guide since 1974 in the Sierra Nevadas and the Rocky Mountains. He ties flies commercially and worked as a saltwater fishing advisor for Fly Fishing Destinations TV show. The Baja Fly Fishing Company has been featured by Warren Miller Productions, The Ron and Raven Show, Fly Fishing Across America, and Michael Falk Productions. Mike, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, good evening. Yeah, this is Mike Reeser, and looking forward to answering some questions and talking about rooster fish.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, Mike. I'm looking forward to it, too. In fact, you know, the other day when we were chatting, we almost had a whole show done in our just chewing the fat there, so to speak, and talking about doing the show. So I know we've got lots of things to talk about. We've got a lot of great questions tonight. We've got questions from California, from Colorado, from Cheyenne, Wyoming, El Salvador, Ontario, Canada, Costa Mesa, California, Minneapolis, Arizona, England, a couple from England, Idaho, Texas, California. I mean, it just goes on and on. So We've got quite the international audience listening in, which is great, too. So I think tonight, Mike, we're going to try to educate people a little bit about the roosterfish, since it's not particularly well documented and known around the world, and talk about the equipment and then the fly strategies and tactics you use, and maybe some trip planning as well at the end. So that ought to keep us busy here for the next hour and a half. Well, let's start with the roosterfish itself. What family of fishes does it belong to? Who are its cousins, and where does it fall in that scheme of things?
You know, I started to do some research for a book I'm writing on species tackle and tips for fishing the Baja, and it's been my understanding for a number of years that they are a member of the Jack family. There's actually a little bit of question amongst marine biologists whether they truly are a Jack or a species, subspecies under themselves. And that kind of brings up what you just touched on, Roger, is that this is a species of fish that has had a very small but dedicated following of anglers, but it is also really a species of fish that we don't know a lot about biologically. So, you know, from a very, very lay perspective, you know, their parents, their activity, behavior and all, it seems to me that they fit well in the Jack family, where originally my understanding is that they reside.
And are they a migratory fish like tarpon are, or do they pretty much stay in the same spot all year round?
They do move. And again, this is an area of somewhat of mystery. We certainly know that as we get into the fall of the year, the larger fish start to disappear from the East Cape. They disappear earlier from further north up through La Paz and around Loreto. And generally, as we get into November, December, January, they do seem to disappear. But one of the things that we have noticed, and it's been sometimes deemed the secret season, is that along with, say, an arrival of ballyhoo, a favored food source of the rooster fish, suddenly there are, you know, 30 and 40-pound roosters prowling the beach on the East Cape and down around towards the Los Cabos area. So I'm not sure if it is as distinct a migration of at a certain point they leave, they go to Zihuatanejo on down into Guatemala or back up. I am not aware of any tagging programs that would track the fish. What I can say, both intuitively and from experience, is that they do tend to disappear from the East Cape area early fall and tend to return again sometime in March, usually following either the ballyhoo or return of the mullet.
And you don't really know if they're just out in deep water or on another coast, huh?
And that's the thing. We do know that the numbers tend to kind of pick up as you get down in southern Mexico into Guatemala, Costa Rica, and probably concentration of fish, probably following food source. And again, these are assumptions that we're making. If they didn't just suddenly seem to appear like in February and then disappear again, it does make you wonder if they move offshore and are looking for other species.
Yeah, I find this so interesting because there are so many fish that we still don't know a lot about. There was an article, and it was one of the fly fishing magazines about, on tarpon in Costa Rica and how they've tagged some of those and realized that those tarpon migrate all the way to Florida, in fact, at times, all the way up the coast through Mexico, Belize, and that's quite a distance for them. to make a journey. So I'm sure there's the same thing with roosterfish that we just really don't know where they go.
I think that once somebody gets the funding to study them, and it's very well that there could be some studies out there that I'm just, you know, as a fishing guy, I'm not aware of. The thing I have found that with, as you mentioned, the tarpon, just about anything that has been tagged and studied, we find that their range of movement in following food sources, water conditions is a lot greater than we assume, and I think it's important when we look at management of any of these species is that we may be looking in very small areas, say the Sea of Cortez, but maybe what they do clean down in Peru or Panama may have an effect on the fishery.
And that's, I think that was part of the point of this article, is that it's kind of like you have to go to the source, and if these fish in Mexico or Florida are coming from Costa Rica, then, and there's a problem in Costa Rica, then we're affecting the whole fishery. So,
right.
Like what you just said, yeah, only
on
the other coast.
We're certainly finding that with yellowfin tuna, where they may be coming from the Indian Ocean, and even though they're netting restrictions, say, in the Sea of Cortez, the root cause may be overfishing, you know, 6,000-8,000 miles away.
Wow.
But to this point, I am not really aware of any extensive research on the rooster fish one way or another, and maybe some of our listeners can enlighten us on that. I would really like to know, because it's a question that I get a lot from our clients and at sports shows, is are they migratory, what family do they belong to, where do they go when they're not there on the East Cape, and be very honest, I'm making a lot of assumptions.
Right. Well, that's good. And if there are any biologists out there that have done those studies, be sure and get a hold of Mike, because he is working on a book on rooster fish, and I'm sure he would appreciate any you know data that he could get. What is their range then? They're in the Sea of Cortez. Do they move down the western coast of Central America, and how far, if they do?
They are, yeah, they're found all the way down into the top end of South America that I'm aware of. They certainly have good populations all through Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua. We were fishing for a while in our business off of Guatemala, and there were plenty of rooster fish around. At that time, it was kind of the newly developed sailfish fishing and really hadn't explored a lot of the rooster fish potential, but definitely Central America, southern Mexico, on up into the Sea of Cortez, up to about Loreto. They'll venture somewhat north of that. On the Pacific side, the waters cool fairly rapidly once you get past the tip of the Baja on the Pacific side to about Todos Santos, and then it seems that their numbers kind of thin out. So the Baja is really about the northern, or I should say the southern end of the Baja, is about the northern extent of their range.
Okay, so you're kind of on the fringe there, so to speak.
It is definitely, you know, the East Cape was acknowledged for a long time as rooster fish capital of the world just from the numbers of fish. Although that was probably one of the earlier places that they were popularly fished for, too.
Well, that's the Baja's changed quite a bit as far as, you know, its notoriety and its ease of getting there. I was there, 30 years ago in a VW Bug. My soon-to-be wife and I camped out for 3 weeks down there on the beaches, and it was quite primitive back then.
You were right in there about the time my first excursions going down in 73, really kind of following the road as it was paved and completed down there. And prior to that, it was like getting to, you know, a Canadian North or Alaskan fishing resort where people there would fly into La Paz, and then from there they would take a small little Cessna 210 or seven-seater and land on a dirt strip at any of the lodges, and that's how you got there to about 73, 74. It was strictly a fly-in type of deal.
Yeah, an interesting story was we were in Mulahay, and the whole town was running off one generator, and the generator went out.
Yeah.
So they couldn't get any ice, and they couldn't pump any gas. So I couldn't get any gas, and so I went out to the local airfield there, looking to see maybe they had, you know, automobile gas out there, and they didn't. But a pilot from L.A. told me, "Oh, you can go ahead and put some aircraft fuel in there; it won't hurt it too much, as long as you got a little gasoline in there, mix it, then." Just try to get some gasoline in there as soon as you can. He says, I do it all the time with my VW Bug back in L.A. at the airport.
Yeah.
So It was pretty funny, but it worked. It worked.
Oh, those
well,
roosters.
Pardon me?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what about the size on the roosters? How big do they get? How fast do they grow? You know, when you've got a trophy-sized fish, do we know how old they are?
And again, this is an area that I would like to see some research on. What I have generally gathered is that they're fairly rapid growing fish, that they get in that 4 or 5 pound range, you know, in their second year. A lot of warm water fish grow quite rapidly. Again, it's an area that I would sure like to see some really good, you know, data on. As far as the size, we see everything from the little, what we call zorillos, little skunks, that are, say, about a pound or so in size, all the way up. The record fish are right in the 100-pound range. A big rooster fish on the East Cape, it would be, you know, 50, 60 pounds. And we've even pushed with on fly tackle fish into that 50-pound range.
What the picture we have on our website there, the one you just caught, what was it, the end of May or so?
Mm-hmm.
What,
definitely
what
the biggest we've ever taken.
And what would you say that weighed?
He's pushing the 60-pound mark, I'm pretty sure. The more we thought about it, you know, our concern with the fish, he was on for quite a while, was getting him back into the water. And, you know, after we got him back in and spent a fair amount of time making sure that he recovered from his little experience with us, it was like, gosh, I wish we'd measured him. And we didn't do a nose to tail and girth measurement, but I do know when we lifted him out, I tailed him with one hand and decided that wasn't near enough and one arm wasn't going to bring him in.
Oh boy.
But he was easy. Yeah, he's a. If people have seen that picture, he's a very, very big fish. Definitely the biggest that we've ever guided or seen caught on a fly.
Well, what's an average size? You know, if a guy goes down there fishing, what's the average size he's going to catch if he's not catching a trophy?
You know, it seems that there's kind of a breaking point in from 20 pounds and above, and when in the school size fish, you know. 3 to 8, 10 pounds are fairly common, and then you get into that larger size category of around, I'd say, in the bigger size fish, you know, maybe 25 pounds would be a pretty darn good fish on a fly rod. And the younger fish we see in larger schools, and as the fish get larger in size, and then they go from, you know, swarms of, you know, say the 5 pounders to threes and fours of, you know, the 20, 30s and twos and threes of the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So they really are quite a wide range. And
right.
This year, certainly we were seeing more of the big fish. We had a double hookup of two fish off the boat on flies that both those fish were in the 35 to 40 pound range. And there was probably 8 or 10 of them feeding together, and we're able to pull two of them off, and both anglers hooked up about simultaneously.
So do they school up then a little bit, or?
Yeah, you definitely see them, especially based on food source. I remember a few years ago we were down there, and this was March, and we had huge schools of ballyhoo came in, and And along with them, just huge feeding schools of right uniform 18 to 20-pound rooster fish, and just literally hundreds and hundreds of them, to where that when you go along in the boat in the morning, it would look like there was a new little rock reef off the beach. It would just be this big, dark spot showing underneath the water, and it was just, you know, masses of rooster fish. Then it seems as the bait that they feed on, if it's a little more scarce and spread out, then the size of the school tends to be to be smaller. So we see especially the smaller size fish schooling in mass together, whereas along the beach and right on the beach where a lot of the big ones prowl, you'll see, you know, the twos and threes and fours.
I see. Okay, good. Well, Mike, we need to take a little break here. So when we return, we'll be talking more with Mike Reeser about stalking roosterfish in Baja's East Cape. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the Striped Bass Game Fish 2006 Symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts last year, just to name a few. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work, on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Mike Reeser about stalking roosterfish on Baja's East Cape. If you would like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Mike your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show as possible tonight. Well, Mike, before we get back to the roosters there, tell us a little bit about what you do as far as a living goes, what your business is, and fill us in a little bit.
Well, I'm one of the partners in the Baja Fly Fishing Company, and we're located on the East Cape and affiliated with the Van Warmer resorts of Punta Colorada, Playa del Sol, and Palmas de Cortez. And we focus a lot of our fishing down there on roosterfish. And as you know, as we were talking the other day, and again a little bit before the show, 5 years ago, people were going, you fly fish in saltwater? To now, just a very keen awareness of the roosterfish. And a lot of the questions we get at sports shows and all are, how do I catch a roosterfish? So roosterfish is a lot of what we do, but we have a general guiding service to the three hotels on the East Cape, and we work both the beach, the near inshore, and the far offshore blue water type of fishing. So we kind of cover pretty much the spectrum of available fish down there, of which we've counted over 30 species of fish that we have caught on fly down there. And we also do light tackle spin and really kind of what people want to cover in the way of their fishing experience down on the Sea of Cortez.
And what is your website address?
Our website is at www.bajaflyfish.com.
Okay, so www.bajaflyfish.com.
Right.
And do you have a phone number that people can reach out?
Yeah, we've got a toll-free that's 877-572-5012.
Okay. And what about a regular phone in case we've got people out of the country that can't use that toll-free?
You can also get us at a couple of different numbers. One is 970-824-2919. One of the other business partners' number is 208-354-2400.
Sounds good. Well, if you need to reach Mike or want to take a trip, you know how to reach him now. And, Mike, you did mention there that it sounds like there's a lot of fish. I know there's tuna down there, there's jacks, there's sailfish. So if a guy went down there for a week or so or two, you can kind of mix it up if you wanted to, it sounds like, depending on the time of year, right?
We do. And what we've been doing a little bit more of, and really kind of from the response and suggestions from our clients, and so many of our clients are repeat clients, is we might do a blue water day where we'll run further offshore with on a cruise or a larger boat and focus more on billfish and tuna, maybe Dorado, a day or two on the smaller, what we call a panga. They're an open boat, center console, and fish sort of the near, what we call the near inshore, and looking for Dorado, skipjack, and that, and as well as swinging in right in close to the beach for the roosters and jack and that. And we also do fish directly on the beach, and that is getting to be a very, very popular way of fishing. There's a lot of species that we can catch right from the sand.
Well, we'll have to talk more about that when we talk about strategies and tactics in a few minutes. Another question came in about their spawning activity. Do you notice, does that have any effect on your fishing for them?
You know, not that I can really tell, and again, I'm really at a loss for good solid knowledge on the biology of them. We do see periods of time in the early spring when the jack crevels definitely seem to be in spawning mode, and you see the daisy chaining behavior, and they just—I mean—you can throw live bait at them, you can throw flies at them, plugs, and they just generally tend to ignore you. I'm not sure that we've been able to attribute that to the lack of catching fish to rooster fish to that, because, well, for one thing, they are and can be a very, very particular fish, very persnickety and difficult at times to get to eat a fly, and a lot of days even get them to take a live bait. They are a very difficult fish at times to catch, and I think that's one of the great appeals of fishing for the rooster fish.
Very challenging, it sounds like. Well, do their I notice they have those spiny dorsal fins, combs. Do you call them combs, or?
Call them a comb, yes.
Yeah. Are they poisonous at all? Do you have to be careful how you handle the fish?
No. They're actually very soft, and you'll hear, you know, the term people at fish forum, the other guides, you know, he's combing out. And what they do when they get very excited and ready to eat, that comb comes up, and they're quite long, given their body size. And I'm not sure if we're right in speculating what it is, but one of the things I've noticed in diving, in watching bait balls and watching the different species and where they feed in that bait ball, I've noticed that the crevels and the roosterfish, both of them being fairly deep-bodied fish, tend to get their prey right on the surface and then use the sides of their bodies to kind of trap and to direct the fish. And you'll see them fishing in pairs, threes, and fours, all of them, all working on the same sorry little sardine or mullet. And I think those combs are kind of like their own little portable net in that they box the prey in. And as the prey darts back and forth on the surface between two or three feeding rooster fish, one of them is going to be able to get the grab. And you'll see them working together quite a bit. And as we talk about the tactics on rooster fish, we take advantage of that feeding behavior.
So when they're underwater, that dorsal fin is actually extended then at times, or only during feeding?
It lays back right along the top of their body, when much like a sailfish. When they're actually swimming, it lays back tight against their body for more aerodynamic, and then it pops up once they get whatever they want to eat right on the surface. And I think then they use that comb as a net or a fence to corral them in. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, how are they doing as a species down there? Is fishing pressure, sport fishing affecting them, or what about commercial fishing?
One of the really good things about rooster fish, and especially the family that owns the resorts that we've been working with, is that they long ago set a catch and release ethic on rooster fish, and it is pretty strongly embraced within the sport fishing community. I see very few rooster fish killed and taken, so it seems that that they are doing much better than some of the other more open water pelagics that traverse the globe and are subjected to pretty intense commercial fishing. In the Sea of Cortez, netting for roosterfish is illegal. Now there is a black market. Generally, it seems that they're fishing for yellowfin croaker and some other species along the beach, and they do catch roosterfish as a bycatch. But by and large, judging from what we saw even this year, we were seeing a lot of big roosters, we were seeing a lot of little roosters, and we're seeing a lot of roosters in between. So we're seeing a pretty good cross-section of the population, and to me that's an indication of health within the species.
So are you saying that they aren't particularly targeted as a commercial fish? I mean, it's illegal, but people do.
Yeah, they're occasionally taken. They're not generally regarded as a good eating fish. The locals in the past used to take them and would eat them. They're kind of on par with the Jack Revel as far as their texture and flavor. So it kind of works, I think, to their advantage that they're not a highly targeted commercial fish. I'm not really aware of that much commercial fishing that takes place for them throughout Central America. If they are, they're caught out of small skiffs, working hand lines. They're not taken, in large scale, such as, a long line or large purse seine.
Okay. Well, that gives us a good idea about the fish, and let's talk a little bit about the equipment you use down there. We have John French from Southern California wants to know what weight rods you use. So why don't you talk about the rods you use down there for them?
Okay. Going back to that earlier question, what is an average-sized rooster fish? And really, we find different categories in different schools of fish. So we kind of span, I would say, the 9 to 12 weight span, depending on the size. Very definitely, the smaller fish are even very catchable on 6 and 7 weights. The problem is when you think that you're into a school of just smaller fish, here comes Bubba, and you hook up on him, and you're wishing that you'd had something bigger. We had a client down there that was fishing in the afternoon after we'd been fishing on the boats, and he took I think it was an 8 weight down on the beach in a small reel, and he got scrambled up on this rock, and we'd been seeing a lot of little horse-eye jacks and green jacks and small roosters, and it seemed very, very adequate rod for what he was catching until the big guy came along. And I mean, he spooled him so fast, he never even got off that darn rock. So, you never know what's going to show up. So we tend to probably select a little bit heavier rod than you might think, especially if you're catching smaller fish. So off of the beach, for the smaller school-sized fish, a 9 weight is generally very adequate, and it will handle some of the larger fish. When we start getting serious about chasing big rooster fish, then you're really starting to look at the 10 to 12 weight, actually an 11 weight is probably about as good a compromise there for, fish that are in the 5, 6, 8 pound, and then suddenly you've got the opportunity and throwing a big fly at something at 30 or 40 pounds. That's part of the problem, is that there's such a size range, and they can show up at any time. It's not like you're going to go to one spot and find small fish, go to another spot, find big fish. You can find them suddenly intermixed in size.
Yeah, because I think just thinking about tarpon, when you have a little school of tarpon come through, they're usually all pretty much the same size. And the baby tarpon are off in the mangrove somewhere, so you know what you're fishing for there. But here they're just all intermixed, so you can have a school with large ones and small ones, and just not know what you're going to get.
I think if you were to go down with just one rod and not, feel over gun for the smaller fish, still being able to push a fairly good-sized fly out and still be capable of handling most of the larger fish, 10-weight rod is a pretty good general all-purpose rod. And the other consideration in this equation, too, is not only the size of the fish, but if you're especially fishing from the beach, In the afternoons, you may get a pretty strong onshore wind, and some of the flies we like to throw are fairly air-resistant flies. So, again, then the size of the rod is almost driven by the size of the fly and the wind conditions you're trying to cast into.
Any particular kind of action you like on the rods for that kind of fishing?
You know, I really think that the action of the rod really is better suited towards individuals' casting stroke to a point. You get too soft, a full flex rod, and then you really lose the ability to drive, you know, the bigger air-resistant flies. We're generally not casting long distance for these fish, even off the beach where you're having to reach out. One of the things that limits you is being able to handle the line and which generally is pretty light wave action, but still, you get too much line. Unless you're, you know, using a stripping basket, you pay the consequence of having that stuff down around your feet. A number of the rods that we use are kind of in the higher end of the mid flex to fast action type of rods.
And what about some of the companies are coming out with these two-handed beach casting rods? What do you think of those today? Give you any kind of an advantage?
You know, we've played with that idea of playing with those, and there are times when a spay cast or just a straight back cast on a two-handed rod would have some advantages in powering into the wind with big flies. The other place that there would be an advantage to this is at times, especially when the southeast winds start to come in, they really start to reshape the beach areas, and a lot of times it'll really start to cut that beach out, and it leaves a fairly steep bank behind you, and it can limit your backcast straight off the beach. Now, that being said, you've got fish that are cruising further out and occasionally fish that bust further out that require longer casts, but in reality, most of the fish that you catch are fish that are moving very close to the beach in search of mullet and other prey species, and they can be just right on that first little wave trough that forms on the beach, 10 feet basically from dry sand, and cruising along there. The intercept on those fish is basically right on the beach at water's edge or slightly into the water and casting up in parallel to the beach along that trough. And so the distance of the cast isn't as great. What I think is more important than the distance and the rod's capable of handling that is more the ability to pick up line, put it down very quickly on these fish. They move very, very fast. On top of being persnickety, they also give you a very, very short shot at catching them. And if you're spending a lot of time with line in the air, you're probably going to be well behind the fish by the time you get it on the water.
Now, do you? It sounds like there is a possibility with the size difference in the rods that they could blow up a rod or blow up a reel on you. So, do you suggest people come down with multiple rods in hand?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Not only because there's such a wide variety of species to be had, to where that if you came down with just one rod, you'd be overgunned for, like, say, ladyfish, the smaller roosters, the small jacks and all. And, yeah, graphite is a wonderful casting tool. It has some limitations in terms of, you know, sharp bends and tweaks and all, and you can break rods. Sometimes it's a flaw. Sometimes it's caused by, you know, the fly hitting the rod, you know, fans. Ceiling fans in the room have probably taken up the stairs, you know, pushing them around the bimini tops on the boats. We had one rod broken by somebody sitting down on it to take a picture. So, you know, those things do happen. You're right on. Having backup rods is important. There really is not a fly shop that you're going to be able to run back to and buy a replacement or rent a rod. They're just, those opportunities are still really not there. If you're going down there, especially on your own, to fish, you want to have some backups and bring all of the terminal tackle that you're going to need.
What about with your particular company? I know you know, I had an experience down in fishing for tarpon in Key West this spring, and you walk in there, and they've got the boat, the guide, they give you the rod, they give you the flies, they rig it up, and do you have those as options for people, too, that are, you know, may not be wanting to invest in a full rig when they're trout fishermen from Colorado or something?
You bet. And really, the high percentage of our new clients are people that are not experienced in saltwater fly fishing. We'll have the occasional person that has an 8 or 9 weight that they've used maybe for a salmon fishing trip. So we do. We provide everything that's part of the package price, is the rods, reels, leaders, flies, and all of that. We certainly don't discourage people from bringing their own tackle, and what we'll do is if they do, then we'll check the knot connections, especially between the backing and the fly line, and the fly line to the butt section of their leader, and then we'll handle it from there. And we're always happy to spend the time if people really want to, you know, if they just do a day to kind of get a leg up on learning, and we'll try to give them as much information and all in the process of that day to where they can go out and do it on their own. Otherwise, yeah, we supply everything.
Yeah, I think that's a really good service that you as guides offer, because for me going down for the tarpon or like folks coming to you for the rooster fish, it was, you know, I had exactly what you said, a 9 weight, you know, for salmon fishing and pike fishing. And he says, leave it home. You're going to blow it up down here. It's mine, you know. So, but that was really convenient. I didn't have to go invest $1,000 to go fishing for a day or two, you know, and knowing that I might not use that again for quite a while. So I think that's a real valuable service you guys offer. So,
well, you know,
go ahead.
No, you know, not only, you know, on the subject of rods, too, there's not every 12 weight is built the same, is designed for the same purpose, too. And what we find in some of these fish, the big jack revel, which we often pick up with the rooster fish itself, are fish that just don't give up. They are very tough fish to move after they've made their initial runs. And some rods that have a very fine casting characteristic may not have the backbone in the lower section of the rod to be able to put the proper amount of pressure on these fish. So the equipment that we use is equipment that we have, you know, we've worked with a number of different manufacturers, and we have found within the certain manufacturers that they have certain lines within their selection that have good casting characteristics, but importantly, they also have good strong butt sections that you can play these very, very strong fish with, and not play them to death either. We want to be able to bring these fish in good condition, and when we release them, be assured that fish is going to go on and make more of its own kind and provide other opportunities.
Right. Always a good idea. Let's take a little break here, Mike. When we come back, we'll talk about the lines you use and your terminal setup. People want to know about that. So,
okay.
So when we return, we'll talk about those things. Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. That Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout, like Wyoming, wyotrout.com, or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 307-237-5997. Again, that's 307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Mike Reeser about stalking rooster fish on Baja's East Cape. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And click on the link below the description of the show that says, click here to ask Mike your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show as possible tonight. Let's talk then, Mike, about lines. What are you using? Floating, sink tip, sinking lines? What are you using?
I would say our favorite line for for rooster fish is an intermediate sink. You can work poppers to a certain extent on a fairly short cast, but overall, we feel that they probably give us the best advantage overall. Now, there's certainly nothing wrong with the sink tips or sinking lines. Casting from the beach, one of the disadvantages for some people, and again, it really depends on the fisherman's experience and how well that they're able to handle the line, but the ability to pick a line and fly up off the water and reposition it can be very, very critical in fishing for these fish, and that's why the intermediate line, we feel, offers the best advantage. Floaters certainly work. Disadvantage to floating lines is, well, first of all, the advantage is that they're very quick to pick up. If your casting skills are not as great, it's probably the easier line to handle and manage. Disadvantages, once the wind comes up, it's a larger diameter line, carries a little bit more with the wind, a little harder to punch into the wind. The wind's coming at an angle towards you. You may end up wearing the fly. And it takes up a little bit more room on the spool for backing, and you lose a lot of the diameter of the spool for cranking. The sinking line is maybe cast better in the wind, but again, you kind of run into some limitations of being able to quickly pick it up. So long answer is the intermediate lines are our choice.
Okay. What about backing? How much backing do you put on these reels?
Generally, you never know what you're going to get into. Smaller rooster fish aren't really going to carry you very far in your backing. The big roosters can take you a long ways in. And if you're fishing from the beach, you don't have the ability to be able to follow them. Now, if they're paralleling the beach when they take off, you're fine. But generally, it's not the direction they go. They go straight out. And so I would say at least 200 yards. If you're really looking at the bigger guys, then it certainly doesn't hurt to have 300 yards. But I'd say at least start with 200 yards. And we generally load most of our reels with 30-pound backing. You can get more on with the 20, and you're still above the breaking strength. But one of the things I found, especially in around salt and sand, in that is that the 20-pound is much more subject to a minor nick breaking the line, whereas the 30-pound gives you a little more assurance that you're going to have the full strength of the line, even if you do get a slight nick.
Right. And then what about your terminal tackle there? Any particular leader setup do you use, knots you use?
We fish fairly simply with our leader systems. Generally, we'll put if you're fishing off the beach, say a 3 to maybe even a 4 foot butt section, but generally usually about 3 foot. And we like to use a softer butt material. We've kind of gotten away from the Mason and the hard Maxima type stuff. We usually use a 40-pound soft butt section, say in the 10 to 12 weight, and say the 8-9 weight, 30-pound. And we simply just do two perfection loops on either end of the butt section and loop the butt section into a loop on the fly line. And that way we can change out our actual tippet. Now, for roosters, they really don't necessitate a bite tippet. And in fact, a heavy bite will tend to hamper the action of the fly, a little more visible with fish, and as persnickety as these fish are, we just simply go from our butt section to a long straight piece of either 15 or 20-pound leader. Now, if I'm fishing bigger roosters, I'll tend to put a bimini with a double loop on it to attach the loop to loop, and then directly tie that a single strand on the other end into the fly. And we use a number of different knots. Called a king sling. I've also seen it listed as the no name knot. We also use the improved loop knot, or some people refer to it as lefty's knot, to attach directly to the fly.
What's the purpose of the bimini twist in there when you say for larger fish? Why are you putting that in there?
The bimini has sort of a it'll twist, and it has a slight spring action to it that on a hard jerk on the fish, it tends to protect not only the bimini knot, which forms the loop end, but it also tends to protect the next knot down in the sequence, to where that you don't get a sudden tightening on that knot and a weakening and breaking of the knot. You know, there's a lot of debate whether it does as advertised. I also tie a spider hitch quite a bit. It's a very fast knot to either form a single loop or to be able to form a double loop to loop into the butt section. One of the things that we often do with the bimini is then we'll take the big loop and spin it again and let it wrap back on itself and tie a double surgeon's knot. It's kind of hard to describe over the radio, but what it does is it creates about a 4 or 5 inch piece of leader that acts like a coil spring, and it gives you quite a bit of cushion against those surges. The big rooster fish, where you tend to break them off towards the end of the fight, is they're very strong head shakes, and those types of real sharp jerks, especially if you're kind of close to the fish, you're pressuring the fish, sometimes they'll break the fly off, and the bimini may give you a little bit of advantage there.
So more
if you don't
of a,
know how to tie the bimini, tie the best knots that you're comfortable with, and go from there.
So it's more, so to speak, a shock absorber of sorts.
Right.
Helps relieve stress in those situations. Okay.
And again, if you're uncomfortable tying the bimini knot, then tie a knot that you are comfortable with. Because a well-tied knot is a whole of any type is a whole lot better than the best maybe choice of knot poorly tied.
And a question just came in from Patty in Idaho. It says, I'm just learning to fly fish. How good of a caster do I need to be? And do you give lessons?
Yeah, we do. Actually, a whole other subject. My business partner has developed a casting teaching technique that develops muscle memory and all without a lot of mechanical description of the cast that really gets people up and casting very quickly. Now, there's two different scenarios, and I'll be very honest. Casting from the beach is a whole lot different and does require much more of a skill to cast, because it is a very quick shot at the fish, often with tricky winds blowing, usually kind of quartering at your face. We get the southeast winds as we get into summer months for right-hand casters that's pushing it right across your body. That if you're serious about chasing on the beach, you definitely want to come with casting skills. Now, on the other hand, we fish a lot out of a boat and either moving in on fish that are feeding in frenzies, or we will pull a live bait teaser that brings the fish in fairly close to the boat. And that's where a person of modest casting skills, and especially after we give a lesson in casting, then that person can target rooster fishes of all sizes. It does. It brings the game down to where at least the casting part isn't the main part of the equation. It's more just getting it to them quickly and the ability to move the fly once it hits the water in the proper manner.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the flies then. First of all, you had mentioned a couple things that the roosters are eating, mullet and what was the other bait fish?
Mullet and ballyhoo. The bigger rooster fish, as they start getting into that 10, 12-pound size, they really start to key in on fairly large food sources. The smaller fish, the sardine, actually it's a flat iron herring that usually swim in the Sea of Cortez in the millions, is the key food source for the smaller fish. So the flies that we tie for them, it really is, it's match the hatch in salt water. If the predominant food source is 2.5 inches long that they're eating, then we go with the fly that is 2.5 inches long. Now, once they make that transition to a larger food source, then the key food sources, definitely the mullet and the ballyhoo. They also will feed on smaller ladyfish and surprisingly bonefish. There are small bonefish not found in large numbers. We don't really have flats down there, but there are bonefish that are found in about 10, 12 feet of water, and they feed on those. So they do have a variety of food sources. Occasionally, the squid will move into the shallows, and they will chow down on those, too.
That was a question that came in after we started, too, was are there any real flats along the Sea of Cortez? I think you just answered that.
No, there isn't. There's some gradual beaches, but for the most part, it falls off fairly steep.
Okay. Now, we've got a couple questions. Jim Hanley, Lyons, Colorado, Roger up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, wanting to know, what are the flies you use? Roger wants to know, what four flies and sizes would you never go rooster fishing without? That's always one of the questions we get on. Phil, Roger, and Jim in on the flies you're using and sizes and so forth. I know, well, you just said the size is determined by the bait fish, but I'm sure there's a certain size hook and so forth you use.
Yeah. Starting, with the sardine imitations in the 2 to 4-inch size, we throw a lot of clouser minnows. And one of the reasons I like the clouser minnow is that once you present it in the water and the rate of retrieve that we use and often ending in a sudden acceleration in the speed of the fly, one of the reasons I like the clouser minnow so much is that it is a very stable fly. It's fairly easy to get tied to where that it balances right in the water. In other words, what you don't want is that fly to come off keel. When you're pulling it through the water, you want it to ride upright like the natural bait does in the water. If it doesn't look natural to these fish, they're off it very quickly. They'll come on it. They'll charge it. But if it doesn't continue to swim like a natural, then they're off it. And some of the overdressed deceiver type patterns where you've got a lot of material underneath the hook shank, around the actual point bend of the hook will tend to push the fly over on its side on a fast retrieve. So the design of the fly probably is as important as the actual selection of the fly that it swims properly. The Mosca Magic for the sardine imitations and the clouser would be two of them. For the bigger mullet, we've been having quite a bit of success with it's kind of a creation of one of the guides down there that fairly simply a fairly large clipped deer hair head and about a 6-inch super hair body. It's the tail end is fairly streamlined, but it has a large head. I think the sonic impression on these fish is important. It seems like, the Mosca Magic fly has got a large, round, epoxy head. The Sea Habit is another pattern that's a good one, and again, it's got a large head, and I think that flies that push a fair amount of water tend to be eaten more often than ones with a smaller, finer tapered head, and the clouser may be successful too because of the barbell eye, and I'm sure that the way the water flows over it must have something that signals eats to the fish.
You said the clouser and the Sea Habit. And the other one you said, I couldn't really understand what you were saying.
The Mosca Magic?
Mosca Magic?
Okay. Yeah, it's a pattern developed by my partner, and it's essentially a flash fly with a round epoxy head.
Okay. Is that, Roger and Cheyenne wanted to know about patterns. Of course, the Sea Habit and the clousers are readily available. What about a pattern for that fly or the other one you were talking about?
Neither one of them. They are pretty much guide-created patterns. that you know, I what I would recommend is if people want to drop us a line, we could, you know, maybe give them the tying description, the recipe for them would be the best thing.
Okay.
Yeah,
great.
They're really neither the Mosca Magic or the clipped deer hair. We haven't even come up with a name for it.
That one, huh?
It's kind of that one.
It's kind of
basically, we borrowed some ideas from one of the guys that guides for us, and he's been very successful with it, and we've taken and played with it and tweaked it, and it's caught a number of very good sized roosters.
Okay. I think that also answers pretty much Michael Johnson, Myrtle Beach, El Salvador. He sent in a question. He says they want to know what to use because they're trying to develop a fishing, I guess a fishing business down there around roosters. So they must have them down there as well.
They do. They do. Costa Rica has, and a lot of people they put their time in on developing and finding the good fishing spots all through Costa Rica.
Yeah. Let's take a little bit of a break here again, and we'll be back in a second. We'll talk about tactics and strategies and so forth. So, Flats Times Charters is your sponsor for this segment of the show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Times Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website. It's www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Mike Reeser about stocking roosterfish on Baja's East Cape. If you'd like to ask Mike a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show that says, click here to ask Mike your most important question, and we'll receive your questions immediately and try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, let's look here. Bruce Browning, Northern Ontario, Canada, wants to know, is color, size, flash, or speed that you think creates hits from the roosterfish more than anything else?
Definitely.
Action of the fly.
Oh, yeah. The action of the fly, you know, I've already touched on that the fly keels properly in the water. I think that is absolutely critical. I think the patterns that push water. I forgot to mention the Rasta fly, and its sort of family is another pattern. It is now commercially available. But again, it has a head that pushes water using fox fur. Motion in the water, yes. I think. Whether it's in the hair material, we tie some of our flies with quite a bit of flash. In fact, what I'll do is on the tail of the fly, I'll sandwich flashaboo into the layers of, say, the fish hair, but I'll leave it extend, you know, maybe 3/4 to an inch beyond the hair portion of the fly, and because it has a lot of wiggle. And again, the larger the head, at the front end of the fly, you tend to get, more water moving over the top of it and interacting with the hair and creating a wiggle. There's days that flash is definitely the key and seems to be one of the trigger mechanisms that get them to eat the fly. The Mosca Magic falls into that category. And the deer clipped deer hair mullet pattern that we're using is very simple and little, if any, flash. You want to experiment. Rooster fish are very persnickety, and there are times that the trigger mechanism may be slightly different from day to day. And a lot of times we're making assumptions, too. Is, you know, you just may be into really hot fish that would eat a tennis shoe sock if you threw it in. And we think that we've created the fly. But so, you know, the individual, you know, mindset of the fish at the time, I think sometimes leads us down a sort of a garden path, thinking that we've now found, you know, something that really works on them.
Any particular size hooks or types of hooks that you use that you prefer?
The definitely for the big fish, they have a very tough mouth, and it can be difficult to get a hook set into them. So I do like the Gamagatsu hooks. They're very sharp. They're very strong hooks for the bigger fish. The smaller guys, their mouths haven't developed, you know, that stringy toughness. We tie a lot on the Billy Pate style hooks. They're fairly readily available, and they're a good sharp hook. I don't tend to go very long on the hook shanks. You get a better purchase and less chance of that fish leveraging the length, you know, the hook shank against where it's, you know, in the jaw and eventually pulling it out.
Size
of hooks?
So we tend
to stay fairly, you know, either standard length or slightly shorter shanked hooks.
Okay. And size of hooks are you using?
Yeah, the size is going to depend on the size of the fly. Now, on the clousers, where you're fishing basically an inverted, you know, the hook point is riding up, I tend to go fairly small compared to the size of the fly. Twos, ones, one-aughts, even for a fairly large fly, because I don't want a wide gape and a large hook to counteract the weight of the barbell fly or barbell eyes and turn the fly over. Now, if fishing for the big roosters and something with a fairly large clipped deer hair head, then I like a wider gape, and that's where, say, the octopus style Gamagatsu's work pretty good, or owner hooks. Again, they're extremely sharp, and I think that helps definitely in getting a good hook set on the big fish.
That seems to be a real popular hook with saltwater fishermen. Yeah. We have a follow-up here question from Jim Hanley in Lyons, Colorado, wanting you to recommend some color schemes on these flies. We didn't really talk about color, so.
You know, most of the fish down there, about three-quarters of the, if you're looking at the fish from the side, is pearlescent white. And so white with either olive to gray to even a little bit of black seems to be what works best for us. I played a lot with chartreuse and some other colors, and they seem to work better for us when we're fishing in, you know, in deeper water, say for tuna, where we're letting the fly sink, or say for pargo and that over the reefs. But I would say most of the stuff we're throwing at rooster fish is predominantly white with a fairly thin topping of olive and gray and black. I would put color probably at the bottom of the list of things that I think are critical. First of all, you know, more the shape, the way the fly tracks in the water, that it appears alive. In other words, you know, you've got material that moves and flows with the movement, and then of course the size of it, and then I'd put the color probably at the bottom there.
Okay, good. Well, we've covered quite a bit there. We need to move on to strategies and tactics here, so let me jump in there. We've got Bill and Mark Rakowski in both Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Costa Mesa, California, son and father here. Mike, my son, age 30, and I are seriously considering a fly fishing trip to the East Cape. There seems to be three ways to fish: beach casting, inshore, offshore, deep water. I favor the beach casting option, which is more like fishing the flats in the Florida Keys, but I think you're going to tell us it's not. But it's more visual. Question, what are your thoughts and suggestions as as we consider each of these different approaches to fishing the Baja waters?
And with the rooster fish, we really don't find them in the deep offshore, although probably they've been on our websites and in ours and the other guide services down there, kind of divide their fishing between the beach, the near inshore, and the offshore. The rooster fish are found very close in. We'll find them maybe a quarter mile off as the water starts to get deeper. If they've circled up a school, say ballyhoo or mullet moving through, but most of the time you're in water that's probably shallower than 20 or 30 feet. So you're working in fairly close to shore, or you are right on the beach. Now, the beach fishing is more sight fishing. There are some elements that are similar to flats fishing in that quite often you are seeing the fish, especially the bigger fish, and either moving along looking for fish or getting in areas where the fish tend to circulate through. You'll see these schools come through repeatedly, and what we've seen, especially when we're out on the boat, those fish are kind of moving along the shore, they'll move out offshore, they'll make a circle and come back around. So you can either move along the shore looking for fish, feeding activity, cruising fish, and then there's certain places that as you learn about beach structure, looking for those, looking for troughs right against the beach with an offshore sandbar, those fish tend to funnel along those troughs, and a lot of times you can get in a position and look for those fish, especially when they come over the sandbar offshore. They show fairly well against the shallow sandy bottom. So there are some similarities to the flats fishing, although it isn't really flats. You're not usually wading. You're pretty much working from the dry shore.
Yeah, you're basically got dry feet when you're fishing for roosters, right?
In a lot of cases, you really are. And you get in too deep. The fish, when they really go on the feed, their intent is to try to push the bait fish right up against the sandy beach. It eliminates, a direction, actually eliminates two directions the fish can go. They can't really go down to escape the fish, and they can't go any further towards the shore. So basically, they can parallel the shore, they can jump out of the water or try to get past them out to deep water. So they try to pin them against the shallow shoreline, and there's a little wave trough that forms from these little waves on the Sea of Cortez that usually gives you about a foot to foot and a half deep trough, and it's about 10 feet from dry sand. And that's usually where the kill zone is when things really start to happen and they push the bait inshore.
And you'll get big fish in that area.
You'll get big fish in that. It's amazing to see these 40 and 50-pound fish cruising, within 20 feet of within 20 feet of shore.
Wow.
The whole shore thing is getting in front of those fish and then getting down in position to where you're casting straight back to the fish. You don't want to line across the fish. Your chances of hooking a fish really decrease as you get more and more of a cast that comes across the direction the fish is swimming. You want to get in front of the fish and cast towards its nose, land about 2 to 3 feet in front of the fish, and then strip very fast away from them.
Well, is it easier to fish from the shore or from the panga than in that area?
It is easier fishing from a panga. Once you spot fish, very often they're already right on top of you, and to get in proper position, you literally have to run at times to get out in front of the fish, get settled, be in position to be able to make a good cast to the fish. So it takes some physical ability, and if you're going to cover a lot of country and looking for where the fish are moving, there can be quite a bit of walking involved and time spent walking, and when it starts getting into June, July, and August, it's very hot, so physically it's demanding to fish from the beach. The boat offers the advantage of being able to move and cover a lot of ground. You can cast to fish working along the beach much like you do from the beach, but it also gives the advantage of using a bait and switch technique where we're using a live teaser bait to bring the fish up close enough to the boat and in a position where you're actually casting straight back to the fish.
So if you're shore fishing, do you find yourself running up and down the beach? Are you, are you seeing fish down the beach, having to chase after them, or kind of give us a feeling of you're walking on the beach? What is it like?
Where it's still, they've limited the ability to chase the fish with four-wheelers in a lot of places. The four-wheelers have become kind of a menace to people that live down there and have property on the beach. They can be detrimental to, turtle nestling. There are a few limited areas that they seem to still be allowing it. That's a very good way to cruise the beach. Just a word of caution, if you go down there anticipating that, we don't know from one day to the next whether they're going to continue to allow it in certain areas. It seems that they've closed a lot of places and fairly suddenly to that. So local knowledge of where the fish are and where they locate is really critical. There's a lot of places you can drive to the beach, get out, walk, and then go to those spots that have these known troughs and sandbars, and then just watch. In the meantime, you might want to blind cast into the troughs for ladyfish, smaller jacks, and that. A lot of times what we'll do is we'll have a rod rigged for smaller species, say an 8 or 9 weight, but then keep the 10 to 12 weight real close. Now, often what will happen is you'll start to get the pattern whether they're moving down the coast or up the coast, Matt. A lot of that has to do with where your tides are and water movement, which I think are critical. Your best times seem to be when you've got moving water current-wise, and it seems the fish move into the flow of the current. So, in other words, on an incoming tide, you tend to see them cruising the beach, hitting in a southerly direction, whereas it's just the opposite with an outgoing tide. So again, you use those things to focus where you're going to be on the beach. If you've got the patience to watch for them coming in those ambush spots, I think in some ways that's one of the best strategies, because you're set, you're composed, you got your line out, and you're in position to be able to make a good presentation. What often happens is when you spot the fish and you run like hell to get in front of them, the tendency is you run out of wind before you're really far enough ahead of the fish. So you stop, plant your feet, try to cast, and all of a sudden you've got the fly in the air, and really the fish is passing you, and it's now at a 90-degree angle to you. The chance of lining past the fish is increased. And really, these fish are not used to seeing something that swims across them to get away from them. They're used to seeing something that's going straight away trying to get away from them. So getting in position to the fish is very important on the beach.
Here, rather be casting at their nose and pulling it away from them.
Right, right.
Similar to tarpon, same kind of thing. I mean, it's just
hermit.
Same thing, yeah.
Same thing. If you can get the fish cruising towards you and you're in position, you're way ahead of the game. A lot of people are chasing rooster fish up and down the beach now. They become quite popular. And sometimes the detriment of yourself, but also, too, is spooking those fish to where that they don't settle down and to where you might get another cast at them. I think discretion is very important with the bigger fish. That it's better not to take a Hail Mary shot in a lot of cases. That fish may swing back out in a little deeper water, and then 10, 15 minutes later, here it comes again along the beach. And they're hard enough to hook as it is. And if you've spooked them once, the second time around, fairly shortly after, it's very unlikely you're going to get that fish to eat.
Well, we've got a question here from Rod Brashears in Texas. He says, do you sight fish for roosters, and if so, how fast and accurate must your cast be? I think you've addressed that. Also, how do you practice for such type of casting? Is it all sight fishing, or do you do any blind casting if you can't see fish? Is that effective at all?
Your chances go down, especially on the bigger fish, but you can catch fish blind casting, and fairly typically what we'll do is if we're either you know, using the truck to get from point to point and then walking, or if we're using the four-wheelers where they're still allowed. In the early morning hours, the glare off the water with the low sunlight is, it's virtually impossible to see the fish until that sun gets up higher. So we'll start off the morning working points, working what we call finger bars, sandbars, troughs, places that the fish will tend to hang and look for bait fish. And we will blind cast to those spots. Usually, the blind cast will produce, you know, the fish that are 10 pounds and under, but we've every once in a while turn up a fish 16, 18, 20 pounds on the blind cast. So, you know, a fly in the water is going to catch more fish than a fly held in hand waiting for Mr. Big to come along. As you get into the bigger fish, the percentage of hookups really go up with the ability to see the fish, move, get ahead of the fish, get in position to intercept the fish, and then cast back to the fish.
Okay. And a question from Steve Yeomans in England. When stalking rooster fish, what lens color do you find most effective for your Polaroid sunglasses?
I like the browns and coppers because we are fishing in relatively shallow, lighter colored bottoms. We tend to find them when they go on the feed. Their preference is to find bait fish along a sandy beach. They can't get in and hide around rocks. These are not ambush feeders that, you know, lay in wait behind, say, rocks and structure and then dart out and grab something. These guys make their living chasing bait fish down. So they basically want to get their food source over a clean sandy beach to where that bait fish can't get away from them. So we're looking for them generally over sandy bottom, especially from the beach area, and that's where those either, you know, the copper or brown tinted glasses give you a little bit better contrast. Now, if you're fishing further offshore, and we were catching some pretty good-sized rooster fish and some really big jacks off in the deeper, darker water, there your gray lenses probably give you a little more edge in terms of contrast and picking that fish up against the dark bottom. So light bottom, lighter lens, dark bottom, darker lens.
Okay. Question from Brian Kotz, Boise, Idaho. He's asking about what you should wear as far as clothing or footwear on the beach to protect yourself. He's heard of stepping on jellyfish and so forth. What recommendations would you have for folks as far as footwear on the beach?
If the jellyfish aren't around, on the soft sandy beach, you can go barefoot if you're fairly, you know, tough-skinned. The beach character changes all the time. I mean, there's times when you've got a softer sand. There's other times it's more, you know, a decomposed granite and be kind of tough on your feet. One of the problems with most footwear is that there is enough wave action slopping in there that tends to pack sand into your boots. A couple different ways you can go is either barefoot. Bite makes a really nice wading shoe that's got an integrated neoprene cuff that's built right into the shoe. They're lightweight, and they shed water. You can wear regular flats boots. Again, most of them don't have, they're designed more for, you know, marl and sand bottoms without, you know, wave action shoving sand in there. So if they don't seal at the top, then you can wear a pair of neoprene like gaiters and around the top there, and that kind of keeps the sand out.
Yeah. Well, what's real quickly, and then we're going to have to close things up here, but any particular hook setting method you use, and once you get them on the hook, what's a rooster fish fight like?
Okay. On the bigger fish, definitely a hook set is important, and a strip strike is the way to go. You cannot, with a fly rod on most of these bigger fish, lift the rod and set the hook. I mean, the rod gives under the pressure of the strike, and that takes away energy from hooking the fish. The other thing it does is it tends to lift the rod up fairly high. The fish bolts. I mean, you can shatter the rod if you get the rod too high. You don't ever want a candy cane on these fish, and this is something a trout fisherman have. It's a habit they've got to break, and we help them in that process of breaking that habit of, you know, lifting the rod high to get a hook set. You keep the rod tip low, and either scissor strip or single hand set. Strip strike to the side and get a good hook set in them. The smaller guys, their mouths are a lot softer, and they really hit so fast that really just kind of a lifting to the side and coming tight on the fish, they kind of set themselves. And as far as the fight on the rooster fish, they are very, very strong fighting fish. Very typically you're going to get a good strong initial run with head shakes. They do come out of the water. I wouldn't call it so much as a jump as it is a crash. They're not elegant jumpers like say a dorado or a tarpon or a sailfish, but they will get out of the water and on occasion and shake their head. The fight is very typical of what you'd get out of a jack revel of the same size. Initial strong, fairly long run, followed by kind of a dogged back and forth. And as the fight progresses and the fish tires, you get them close, you're about halfway through the fight. They turn their body size against you and use that flatter body size, much like the jacks do. And so the end of the fight can be fairly close in, you know, length of fly line, short runs into the backing, but it can be fairly prolonged. They do not give up very easily. They're very, very tough fighting fish.
Well, sounds exciting, Mike. I'm sure many of our listeners are going to want to come down and give it a try, but unfortunately it's time to wrap things up for this show. So we will close it off there. We'll say goodbye to you in just a minute, Mike, but when we return, we're going to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, so stay tuned to see if you win. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.family, and that's T-Y-E-S, familyties.com, and take a look at what they're doing. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away the 3-year membership of the Federation of Fly Fishers and the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. So if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but be sure you do so for the next show because we're always giving away great prizes. So the lucky winner will contact after the show and take care of their address and so forth then. So I'll press my magic button here, which will do the random drawing for me. So what we're going to draw for is a 3-year membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers. And this is going to be going to John Kimura. John Kimura, and he's in California. So congratulations, John. And then let's give away the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And that's going to be another Californian, John French. John French. So both in California, enjoy your gifts. I'm sure you will. They're both high-quality things that will definitely teach you about fly fishing. Well, Mike, we really appreciate you being with us tonight and for taking time out and sharing your experiences down there. You've got a lot of years in the business and in the water down there, and we sure appreciate you sharing those with us tonight.
Well, I certainly enjoyed and really pleased to see some really good questions that have come up from folks show the interest that they have in the fishing.
Yeah, and we still had more to go. We really didn't talk about trip planning and so forth, but you know, it's always the case we run out of time because we have too many questions. But of course, if you're wanting to plan a trip, contact Mike directly and he'll fill you in. Even I'm sure he's a nice guy. If you want to go camping, he'll tell you about that. If you want to stay in his hotel down there, he'll tell you about that. So just contact Mike and Baja Fly Fishing, and they'll take care of you. Well, I wanted to also make mention tonight real quickly is some people might want to know about Don Bishop, my co-host. He's been in and out lately. He's got a lot of projects going on in the fly fishing world, and that's taken some of his time away from us. He will be probably on an upcoming show and talk about his adventures and his projects. But just to know, he will not be a full-time host anymore, but we will have him back as a guest host, and you might find him out there as kind of a roving reporter, too. So don't be surprised if he doesn't interview you on the spot and talk to you that way. So just want to kind of fill people in and on what he's up to, and he'll do that in more detail down the road. Well, on our next broadcast, which will be on July 25th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on that show we're going to interview Landon Mayer, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing for big, huge, monster trophy trout. Passion and love for the sport of fly fishing is what motivates Landon. His success in catching trophy trout is fueled by an addiction of pursuing large trout with small flies and lightweight fly fishing equipment. Listen in on our next show to hear Landon share his secrets on sight fishing for huge trophy trout. Well, we'd like to thank Mystic River on the Nantahala, the Federation of Fly Fishers, Platte River Fly Shop, Flats Time Charters, and Family Ties for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.